You're listening to AM 970, The Answer. And now, Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, the president of Teamsters Local 237.
Welcome to another edition of Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237. With me, our very special guest for today is Congressman Dan Donovan. He represents Staten Island and parts of South Brooklyn in the 11th Congressional District. And I want to welcome him to first time to Reaching Out. Welcome.
Good to be with you, Gregory. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And I want to say our union endorsed you.
Yes, you did. And I'm very grateful.
And
the membership does great work. As you know, my dad was a union member, ILA. I was a beneficiary of being a family member of a union worker. I know what unions do for hardworking families, hardworking people. And I'm one of those rarities, Gregory. I'm a pro-union Republican. They don't find many of us down in Washington, but you got folks like myself, Pete King, who's been a guest many times on your show,
yes,
who support hardworking American union workers.
And I have to say, you and Pete King have something, a lot of things in common. You're both from New York State.
Yes, sir.
You're both on the Homeland Security Committee.
Yes, sir. Yes.
And you're both pro-law enforcement. And you used to be the district attorney of Staten Island.
I was district attorney of Staten Island. I was assistant district attorney for Mr. Morgenthau in the Manhattan DA's office. Pete's dad was a police officer, so we have a great law enforcement background in our families. In my career, my earlier career, and certainly those brave women and men who put on a uniform every day to protect our families, deserve all of our support and the credit that they sometimes don't get in the media.
And I also have to congratulate you. I love sports. Unfortunately, I saw the Little League World Series and rooting for the kids from Staten Island. They played well. I mean, the experience that they had was second to none, but unfortunately is over for them.
Yeah, we're proud of them, though. They put up a good fight. They were hardworking. They were successful, dedicated young people, and the coaching staff, you know. Those people who give up their time to teach other people's children. And it's not just baseball. They learn discipline. They learn camaraderie, teamwork. There's so many aspects of Little League baseball. So I congratulate our team, and I also recognize the importance and congratulate their coaching staff for what they did.
Thank you. Now, I want to speak to you about a pension bill. There's pension issues and legislative proposals in Congress to fix some of the pension problems for, I would say, a lot of union pension funds across the country that, for no fault of the members, have gone broke. And I know you were supportive, and you are supportive in that measure, and so is Peter King.
Yes.
And I just wanted you to expound on that for our union members.
Yeah, Gregory, I mean, you have people who worked their entire lives, were promised that at the end of their careers, there'd be support, financial support for them and their families afterward. And as you pointed out, and they've contributed,
sure,
contributed to those pension plans, and they've seen their funds grow. And their hope is that after their career is ended, that there'd be money there to take care of them for the rest of their lives. And in some cases, poor decisions made by some people making investments in those funds, and a lot of those pensions went broke. But, you know, government came to the rescue. And yes, you're right. Pete and I supported the funding of those pensions where people were promised something and lost or had the potential of losing the income for the rest of their lives after they had already earned it and they already paid into it. That's just unfair to the workers. Glad government came to the rescue there. That's part of the job that we're supposed to do. We're supposed to support the American people. And after 30 years of hard labor and working with the hope of the future that you'll be taken care of, we had to come and help those folks out.
Yeah, and going forward, there's a legislation, the Butch Lewis Act.
Yes.
Will probably not this session, but the next session will be going forward. And I know you and Congressman King will be supportive of that.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Well, right. Between now and the election November 6th, the entire House of Representatives is up for re-election. A third of the Senate's up for re-election. you won't see that go to the floor this time, but after January 3rd in the next Congress, we hope to see it go to the floor. We hope to pass it in the House, and we hope the Senate takes action after we pass it.
Thank you. Thank you for your efforts, and we appreciate your support. I want to talk to you about your position on the Emergency Preparedness Response and Communications Subcommittee. I want to talk to you about what is emergency preparedness?
Well, yeah, I was very fortunate, Gregory. I came into Congress in between classes. The class of 2014 had been elected and seated. My predecessor resigned after that, so there was an opening. I took office in May of 2015 when most of the class took office in January. And when they place a new congressional class, they give the assignments to the committees. I was looked upon as the person that would probably win that race, so they kept a seat on Homeland Security Committee open for me. Coming from New York City, the number one terrorist target in the world, and living in a community that was devastated by Superstorm Sandy, this was an amazing opportunity for someone like myself to take the reins of that subcommittee. I was on the committee for a short period of time when I was given the chairmanship of that committee. Now I lead our efforts in anti-terrorist policies and preparing for emergencies like a natural disaster, like a Superstorm Sandy. So there's three aspects to it, as it's very clear from the title. It's emergency preparedness, preparing for the possibility of an emergency, whether it be a terrorist attack or a natural disaster. What's our response to that? And how we learn as we look at the responses that we've had in other places. I visited Puerto Rico twice after the hurricanes last year, once 2 weeks after the storm, and then later on about 3 or 4 months later to see how the recovery effort was coming along. What did we learn from Puerto Rico? What were the deficiencies in helping the poor people who were devastated by that storm? So we do that, and the third part is communications. As we saw, unfortunately, September 11th of 2001, the communications between the fire chiefs and the firefighters in that building went down. the other emergency responders didn't have any communication. So allowing rescue workers, first responders to communicate during a disaster is so important. So those are the three aspects of the committee. And as you said, I chair that committee. I'm very fortunate. But it's a great place to have me and being a New Yorker, the only Republican member of Congress from the city of New York, to be leading that effort.
Well, let me ask you, you said you went to Puerto Rico two times.
Yes, sir.
What did you learn in Puerto Rico?
The first time I visited, as I said, Gregory, I was there 2 weeks after the storm. The island was devastated. All the beautiful greenery was gone. The entire island was brown. They took us up in Black Hawk helicopters. And for a guy who's afraid of heights, it wasn't too pleasant of a trip. But just to see the entire island was just devastated by the storm. The storm was bigger than the island of Puerto Rico. And when it hit the island, it started moving at such a slow pace that it sat over the island for about 36 hours.
Wow.
They received a year's worth of rain in 36 hours. A lot of the infrastructure had been compromised, the electrical grid, the poles that carry electricity up to the mountains, the debris that was in the harbor. You know, it was such a unique rescue effort and then a recovery effort because it's isolated. We had storms, Superstorm Sandy, when we had the storms in Texas, we could take Teamster truckers and truck supplies and rescue materials to those places. You can't truck the things to Puerto Rico, and the harbor was so jammed with debris you couldn't get ships in there. So it took a long time to even get there and to bring the supplies that people needed. When your electricity goes out, your water filtration system goes out. There was no clean drinking water. The hospital system went out. The Army Corps of Engineers had to go in there and try to clean that out. Department of Defense had to clean debris. We couldn't get trucks up the roads to get to people. So it was people, here we are, the year anniversary of the storm, and people are still suffering. People still haven't recovered. It's going to take a long time.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that assessment and the update on what you saw. Mm-hmm. So that's emergency preparedness, Homeland Security. How are we doing with the Homeland Security? How are we doing with that?
We're doing very well. Many of the efforts that we have in the area of homeland security, many of the assets that we have in place to protect people aren't necessarily visible to folks. They're going through Grand Central. They may see someone in an army uniform with a police dog and a large weapon and say, "Wow, I'm glad they're here." There's so many other measures in place to protect our commuters, to protect people at a big gathering, a Super Bowl, the NBA playoffs, a convention. We're going to have the U.S. Tennis tournament, U.S. Open tennis tournament in New York shortly. There are measures in place that protect people that aren't as visible. I tell people, be cautious, but go enjoy your lives. The brave people who are in charge of protecting our nation are doing a great job at it.
Very good. It's assuring to know that we're protected. Even though we don't see what's going on, we know something is there. And I know something's there. I said nothing can be this open.
Right. Yeah.
Something is somewhere. There's an eye in the sky. Something's going on here.
I tell people, by the time you get to that metal detector, that magnetometer at Giant Stadium or MetLife Stadium to see a football game or a soccer game, you've already been through about five levels of security that you don't even know you've been through. So we certainly, because of the bad guys, listen to the media as well. We don't want to give out methods or sources how we do this. But I assure your listeners that their families are protected. There's great work being done in that area. Please go out, enjoy yourselves, go visit the Empire State Building, go down to Washington, D.C., see the Capitol, go to a ball game, go to a concert. Your family's well protected.
Thank you. I'm sure everybody listening are delighted to hear this. Now, I want to talk to you about a crisis in our country, and lately it hasn't been getting much publicity. Beginning of the year, it may have gotten more publicity. Last year, it got a lot of publicity. But the opioids, it's still a crisis in our country. It's taken the back seat to a lot of other issues, but there's still a lot of people that are in need of help, and it's still a very addictive drug.
It's been declared to be an epidemic and a national crisis by the president. That's how important this is. As you said, mentioned earlier in the show, I was the elected district attorney of Staten Island for 12 years, and a lot of the national problems were very evident in the community that I represented. You had very young people dying from overdoses, and people said, how did this happen? How did this occur? How can we have so many people addicted? Well, a lot of the addictions that we've seen began innocently. You had an operation on your knee, something happened to your back, or you twisted it and you're in pain, and a doctor had to prescribe a medication to you that when it was first introduced to the public, we were told it was non-addictive. It goes back to about 1996, Gregory. Years ago, doctors were required to measure four measures of someone's health. They have to measure your blood pressure, your temperature, your respiratory rate, and one other. I forget what it was, actually. And then in 1996, they were told they had to measure pain and treat pain, too. The others, your temperature's, it's objective. You tell me that your temperature is 98 degrees and I can measure it and it's 102. The other pain is subjective. I have to believe you. There's no way to measure someone's pain. And since doctors were required to treat it, they started writing scripts for what were thought to be non-addictive painkillers. Problem was they were addictive. So many people became addictive unknowingly, unwittingly, and innocently. And this population continued to grow. And so we saw an epidemic of people abusing prescription painkillers. When we started to curtail the availability of those drugs, you saw people who were already addicted turn into the streets to heroin. Heroin is cheaper. Not that they're all dangerous, but the danger with buying something that's not regulated by the FDA is you don't know what you're getting in a bag of heroin. You'd be shooting rat poison, or what we're finding now is heroin laced with fentanyl. Oh. Fentanyl is 50 times as powerful as heroin, and someone innocently thinking that they're ingesting heroin is now ingesting something 50 times as powerful, and their bodies can't take it. So we're seeing a massive number of overdoses and deaths. I think we'll get our arms around this. I think we will continue as we shrink the pool of people abusing prescription drugs. We're shrinking the future pool of heroin abusers. It just may take us a while to see this through.
What can be done? Should we raise more awareness?
Yes,
should
sir.
We? Because I remember at the Teamster convention in 2016, there was parents that were there, and their son had died of a opioid overdose, and the Teamsters immediately raised something like close to $250,000. I mean, and it looked like seconds. Everybody was giving money.
It's just so sad what's happening to families.
And it was 2 years ago.
Yeah, a lot of them are young people. Yeah. You ask what can be done. It's a three-prong approach. It's like a tripod. You have to do all three aspects of the addressing the problem. You're right. Awareness is very important. People who have not yet experimented have to be made aware of the dangers of this. People who probably maybe own a firearm legally, probably secure it in their home, lock it up. There are many people with teenage children might lock up their liquor cabinet so the kids can't. Nobody locks up their medicine cabinet. And, you know, somebody gets a prescription from a doctor and it's in the medicine cabinet and appears to be safe. The FDA said this is 30 milligrams of oxycodone. Your mom, grandma, your dad, your grandpa has it in a medicine cabinet. It must be safe. So there's this awful perception, inaccurate perception, that there's no danger to these drugs. So educating people who have yet to experiment is very important. The second prong is making treatment availability. I am the product of an alcoholic father. My father, though, being an alcoholic, found the rooms of AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, when I was 8 years old. I understand what recovery is about. There are people who are desperately in need of a bed somewhere and a program that will help them through their addictions. And some of these addictions are very, very difficult. When I was a prosecutor in Manhattan, we had an informant in my office one day who was giving up information about drug dealers who himself was abusing and got drug sick in my office. You've never seen something like it. It's not just vomiting. I mean, the convulsions this person was going through, that their body was withdrawing from the substance that they had ingested. So we have to have beds available and programs available for people, and they have to be readily available. When somebody's ready to go for treatment, they have to go then. You can't tell them to come back next Tuesday because they won't come back. But I am a believer. We had a very successful drug treatment court when I was the DA of Staten Island. We diverted people out of the criminal justice system into a treatment program, and we saved a lot of people's lives through that. The third aspect of it is there still has to be a law enforcement leg to this tripod. We still have to punish people who are peddling poisons to our children, people who are lacing heroin with fentanyl and giving it to unsuspecting users or abusers. So there still has to be an aspect of law enforcement. We have to protect. Most of the fentanyl is coming from China or Mexico border. It's not done, made here. So we have to secure the borders for that. And we have to certainly give the men and women who are out there trying to rid our neighborhoods of these poisons the resources, the assets, the equipment to do the job and do it safely.
You're listening to Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, President of Local 237 Teamsters. Our very special guest is Congressman Dan Donovan of Staten Island. We want to talk to you about the Veterans Administrative Hospitals, particularly the one in Brooklyn. I believe that's in your district and that system, and more accountability.
Yeah, you know, the VA system is the largest health organization in the country, and we cannot do enough for our veterans. When they come back from volunteering to put their lives in harm's way for our freedoms, we can't do enough for them. And so healthcare, providing healthcare in a VA system is so important. And why it's important in a VA system, those medical staff, whether it be nurses, doctors, physician assistants, dealing with soldiers, sailors, airmen, Coast Guards members, they recognize things in a veteran that maybe an ordinary doctor who's just treating them for a pain in their shoulder wouldn't recognize. What I'm talking about is the effects of war on someone's mind. The women and men come back with post-traumatic stress disorder. A person in a VA hospital recognizes that maybe more so than someone who's just an orthopedist who works on elbows and might not see that. So it's important to provide that service. But the VA also has to be accountable. And it's a difficult situation. We've seen some mismanagement, not in the Brooklyn VAs. I met Monday morning with the head of the Brooklyn VA, and she's doing a wonderful job there with the resources that she has. Anybody who goes into that profession wants to help veterans.
Right.
They chose that as a career, to work in a VA hospital rather than any other hospital, because of the love, the bravery of the people who go overseas and defend our freedoms. So we have to support them. At the same time, we have to hold them accountable. It's a lot of waste, as there is in many government agencies. And so we're there not to tear them down, but to build them up, but build them up the right way.
Okay. So what are some of the most pressing issues right now facing Congress?
Well, you know, there's always going to be, America is always going to be a target to terrorism. New York City is always going to be the number one terrorist target in the world. We could do all other things for our citizens, you know, lower taxes, provide better benefits. If they're not safe, none of that's going to matter. So the safety of our nation, the safety of our citizens is the number one priority and the number one responsibility of government. And providing opportunities is the next thing, Greg, I'd like to say. Providing an opportunity for education for American children. Providing an opportunity for a job for an American worker. Those are things that government shouldn't dictate, but government could provide an environment to stimulate that. You know, we had the corporate tax bill passed with lowered corporate taxes, geez, nearly 17%. What we found, what happened then was companies were doing better. Companies started hiring more people. Companies started raising salaries for folks. They gave out bonuses to their employees. So was government's role to tell those companies to do that? No. Government took action, though, to allow that to happen.
And provide the opportunity.
Yeah, provide the opportunity. We shouldn't dictate how the Teamsters work. But what we should do is say, how do we help Teamsters with salaries, compensation? How do we create an environment where companies need more Teamsters working so we provide more opportunities so your membership expands? Sure. That's what government's role here is, not to dictate, but create an atmosphere and take actions that will allow the public sector to do it on their own.
And we have about a minute and a half. Is there anything that you want to convey to our listeners that we haven't covered?
Well, I I'm not making a pitch for myself, but I think one of the things, and you find that out as well, Greg, because you have an election too, is that we need people to exercise their rights. I will never forget when Iraqi women were allowed to vote for the first time. And there was pictures on the front page of every newspaper of these women who waited online for 3 days in pouring rain to cast their vote because they were permitted to for the first time. And they had to stick their finger in the purple dye, and they had the, so you couldn't vote twice. Right. They'd make you put your finger in the dye. And we have so many people in our country who don't use that, exercise that great privilege, that great right that we have. So whoever you vote for, whoever your preferred candidate is, whoever your preferred party is, whatever your preferred philosophies are, please go out to exercise your right to vote this year, next year, and throughout.
And I believe Election Day is
November 6th.
November 6th.
My 62nd birthday.
And the primaries are September
13th.
So everybody, you have primaries on September 13th. Election Day is November 6th. And we want you to go out and vote. We didn't say who to vote for, but it's we're just using the air to say vote. September 13th, November 6th. Please, let's have a good turnout in our elections this year. It's very important that everybody voice is heard, and this is one way your voice is heard. Believe me, it makes a difference. I want to thank you, Congressman Dan Donovan, for coming on, reaching out, and we'd like to have you back. Anytime you have an issue, you want to convey something to our listeners and your constituents, please feel free to come back.
Good to be with you, and I thank your listeners for listening.
Thank you. I'm Gregory Floyd, President of Local 237. You were listening to Reaching Out. A very special guest, Dan Donovan. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, President of Teamsters Local 237. Join us each and every Saturday night at 7, right here on AM 970, The Answer.